We're doing our Parsha class. It's the first week of the new semester. Welcome back. It's good to be back. We did not get a chance to discuss Parashat Bereshit, so we're going to have to take a little bit of time to introduce Bereshit and then go on to Noach. And so my first question to you guys is, what's the purpose of the Torah? Basic question. Starting Torah, what's the point?
Blueprint of reality.
Blueprint of reality. Okay, big words. Okay.
Every way, shape, or form.
Okay. Do you guys get a chance to read the first Rashi in Torah? What does the first Rashi say?
It talks about how the Torah was given so that when nations come to contest it.
All right. He says, why did the Torah begin from creation? The Torah should have begun from, what does Rashi say? From where should the Torah have begun? From the first mitzvah. Hachodesh hazeh lachem. So what do we infer from Rashi? What is the purpose of Torah? At least from Rashi's question. If the Torah should have begun with the first mitzvah, Rashi is giving us a perspective that the Torah is...
to establish Hashem as king of the
universe. I think the guidebook to mitzvahs. He says it should have begun with the mitzvahs. Torah is a book of mitzvahs. Ah, no, we have to teach, we have to learn about creation, we have to be taught that we have a right to the land of Israel. We will have to explore this question with greater depth. What is the purpose of all the stories of Bereshit? We're reading stories, and what I don't want to do is to read them as seven-year-olds. You guys aren't seven-year-olds. Now, there's a balance I have to maintain as we learn these classes, because on the one hand, you need to have what we call girsa diankusa, what your nursing children, not literally nursing, but what your children will come home with and tell you the stories they tell you, you need to know them. You know, my son went to Gan. So he's 4 years old, 5 years old. The story goes back a decade ago, right? And the kindergarten teacher takes them outside and she takes a big bucket of water and she makes a huge circle of all the kids and she throws the bucket of water in the air and all the water comes splashing down. And she says, what'd you just see? So they say, we saw water splashing down. She said, you see, water doesn't stay up. But Hashem created the heavens to keep the water up. We can't do it. But till today, in their mind, they see that bucket of water going up and splashing down. Doesn't work, right? Can't stay up there. Ah, but Hashem, when she discussed creation of day one, day two, day three, so the kids start understanding. What does it mean, a rakia? My goal in our Chumash class is to cover the following. The basic midrashim your children will come home with, so that you'll know what they're talking about. Number two, to cover the basic philosophies of the Rishonim, the early commentaries, Ramban, Radak, Ibn Ezra, Sephorno, Rashi, Rambam, to cover the basic philosophies of the Torah that are expressed by the Rishonim, and finally, to cover the mitzvot, that we will also have a picture of the 613 mitzvot we encounter in the Torah. When we begin Torah, our assumption is that all the mitzvot are not relevant. Wow, did you just hear that? What does that mean they're not relevant? Noach was a non-Jew. The Talmud says Noach was not Jewish. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, they are the fathers of the people of Israel, but they're not yet Jewish. Judaism begins from Yaakov onward, from Moshe Rabbeinu onward. Halachically, Judaism begins from the stand at Sinai. We learn the laws of conversion from what the Jews underwent at Sinai. That's where we derive the laws of conversion from. How do we know what a convert has to undergo? So the Talmud derives it from the process of Sinai, meaning Judaism actually began at Sinai. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are the Avos, they are the patriarchs. So we have Nevi'im, we have prophets. Adam Arishon was a Navi. Noach was a Navi. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov were Nevi'im. But when we speak about Am Yisrael, so that begins with Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Yehudi, or Yisrael, and Torah and Mitzvot, begins with Sinai. So then what are we doing here? So in Bereshit, Hashem says, Pru Urvu, have kids. That's not our commandment of Pru Urvu. That's commandment to the world. So the Mitzvot that are expressed until the giving, until Parshat Bo, when Hashem is giving Moshe commandments to the Jewish people, will have to be reiterated on behalf of the Jewish people, because they are commandments to people before Judaism. Now, what one of the hardships I have in the class is that almost everything we discuss has multiple opinions. I have to choose one. So even what I just said is discussed in Talmud. But I'm going with the more generally accepted opinion, or the one I think that will help us best understand what we're studying. I'm just saying this clause in advance. We're starting a new semester. I do have to choose. That means I can't. It would be too confusing to go through the varying opinions as we go through. I don't always remember them, obviously. But even if I do, I can't. So let's quickly run through Bereshis and then run into Noach, okay? So we have 6 days of creation. Our assumption is they are 24-hour periods, even though that remains to be discussed. At the end of creation, man is created, Adam HaRishon. The concept of Adam HaRishon is a halachic concept. It's not just a fictitious folklore. The Talmud, the Mishnah says in Sanhedrin, all of humanity came from one man so that there would be greater unity among humanity, so that we would have more respect for one another. The Mishnah gives numerous reasons so that we would value the individual. We see all of humanity came from Adam HaRishon. There are many themes, there are many lessons that we're supposed to learn from this idea of an Adam HaRishon. So you'll ask me, was there man before Adam? And I'll say no. But yes. But no. What do you mean? So we have Midrashim about worlds that preceded this world. We do have in the Midrash, long before they found the dinosaurs, the Midrash said that Hashem created worlds and destroyed them until He created this world. What does that mean? I don't know.
Doesn't the Rambam also talk about like other beings?
Show me.
At that point. If I remember correctly, it's in Bar Nevuchim, and he derives it.
Show me. Okay. After you show me, then we'll discuss it, okay?
Gotcha.
So, we move forward. We have the concept of prophecy. God talks to Adam. Adam, Chava, they're commanded not to eat from the forbidden fruit. What is the forbidden fruit? Multiple opinions. Is the forbidden fruit grape? Is the forbidden fruit wine? Is the forbidden fruit an esrog, citron? Is the forbidden fruit a fig? Is the forbidden fruit wheat? Yes, we have many opinions. What is the, or is the forbidden fruit a different fruit that we don't even know what it is? Or is the forbidden fruit not even a fruit? It's talking about intimacy. As it says in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, when we speak about the tree is a euphemism for man being intimate with his wife, which was only supposed to happen, as Chazal tell us, the forbidden fruit was supposed to be eaten only in a few hours. He was supposed to wait, and he didn't. So we have Adam sins with the forbidden fruit after Chava, Eve sins with the forbidden fruit, and this is all instigated by the Nachash. What is the Nachash? Some kind of creature which can talk. According to the Midrash, it had the angel on its head, the Samael, who does the talking, and he can convince Chava to eat. She sees she's going to die. She doesn't want Adam to marry someone else. She convinces him to eat. We have two opinions about whether he knew he was eating the forbidden fruit when he ate it. Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, the Midrash says, she gave him to eat, and right after he ate it, he said, "What'd you just feed me?" Right? He didn't even know he was eating it. And we discussed the Drashot HaRan. The Ran says that death that came from eating from the forbidden fruit was not a punishment. It was a natural evolvement. That wasn't a punishment. And so Hashem gives 10 curses to the snake, and 10 curses to Chava, and 10 curses to Adam. And Adam is chased out of the Garden of Eden. Cain and Hevel are born. Cain has one twin sister, Hevel has two. Cain is jealous of the fact that his brother has two wives. His wife is more beautiful than he is. They bring a sacrifice. Cain's is not accepted because Cain just gives leftovers. Cain gives flax, right? He gives this linen, and Hevel gives wool, and that's why we have kilayim. We're not allowed to mix wool and linen. That represents Cain and Hevel. We know today that in NASA, I was told, I didn't check this, I was told that you cannot have wool and linen together. and any of the fibers of the spaceships, because wool and linen cause micro sparks. We come back, so Cain and Hevel, Cain gets really upset, so he starts a fight with Hevel and he loses. And Cain is pinned to the floor and Hevel is ready to kill him. Hevel says, "You were ready to kill me." And Cain says, "Please don't kill me. I'm your brother. Don't kill me." And Hevel has mercy. So Hevel lets go. And Hevel gets up and walks away. Vayakom Cain. And Cain gets up off the floor and pounces on Hevel and proceeds to murder him. And then hides the evidence. Hashem asks him, "Where's Hevel?" Cain says, "Am I responsible?" And Hashem, Cain thinks that he can trick Hashem, and Hashem says, "All his future seed is crying before me." And so Cain gets punished, and Cain says, "I can't handle this." And Hashem teaches him, first Hashem taught him he could do tshuva, and then with his claims, Hashem makes his decree more light. We move forward, 7 generations later, Cain has a great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter named Naamah. Right after Cain is killed by his own great-great-great-grandson, Lemech is blind, he's hunting. His son, Tuval Cain, guides him to shoot, and when he shoots, they go to see what animal he killed, and turns out he killed his great-great-great-grandfather, Cain. He's so upset, he claps his hands together and kills his own son, Tuval Cain, who was standing right there. And then he's standing there blind. He can't find his way home. His two wives come looking for him, Ada and Sila. And they both say, "If you killed Cain, look at what a decree we're going to get. We're not willing to mate with you." And they take their case to Adam Arishon, Adam, who has spent 130 years separate from his wife, Chava. Their marriage lasted all of 2 hours. And then they spent 130 years separate. Adam was upset at what had happened. He was trying to do tshuva. And then Adam tells them, "Guys, get back together again." And they say, "Oh, you're telling us? Why aren't you?" And Adam says, "Fine, I will." And that's when he has the son Shit, from whom all of humanity comes. But it's not so accurate, because Cain's great-granddaughter, right? Great-great-great-great-granddaughter, well, was Lemech's daughter, Naamah. Right? Naamah is the sister of Tuval Cain, and she is the wife of Noah. So when we enter our parsha, Noah, who is the first one to be born without webbed fingers, his hands are separate fingers. When Noah is born, Noah marries Naamah and has no children. Everyone around him is having kids, and Noah doesn't have kids. When we approach Noah, we're approaching someone who is complex, like many figures in Tanakh. On the one hand, Noah is a tzaddik in a generation where people are stealing one another's wives, people are stealing from one another, and Noah is pious. On the other hand, Hashem tells him there's going to be a flood, and Noah doesn't believe it. And so it starts raining, and Noah doesn't enter the ark so fast until he can't stand it anymore. And so Chazal tell us, Miktanei Amanaya, Noach was one of the smaller believers in world history. Miktanei Amana, what a line. Torah says, Tzadik, Tamim, Hayah, Bedorotav, Et Elokim, Italech, Noach. So many words of praise. Chazal tell us, yeah, but read between the lines. So Noach was tasked with the duty. He was forewarned 120 years before the flood that there would be a great flood. And it was just after there was a great tsunami and one third of world civilization was wiped out. So it was believable. They had just seen a huge natural disaster. And Noah is coming to convince the people there's going to be a flood. There's just one problem. That Noah didn't believe it that much. So he's given the task. He's going to spend 120 years telling people, you got to do tshuva. There's going to be a flood. But when the flood actually happens, Noah is standing there and he's waiting till he can't handle it anymore. And then he goes into the ark. So Noah doesn't succeed too much in those 120 years. And Chazal have harsh words of criticism about Noah, because Noah saved himself. He did not save his generation. He didn't pray about the generation. He could have built 15 Machon Meirs and he did not. So Chazal give a harsh rebuke of Noah. On the other hand, all of world civilization starts with Noah. You know, it's easy for us to rebuke him. Noah lived at a time like that, and he was pious. Everyone else was immoral, and he was moral. Now, Noah is the restart of civilization. And from Noah to Avraham Avinu's 10 generations, but Avraham Avinu met Noah's son, Shem. And this is an important point in world history because there are two approaches, Kuzari and Ramban. When Moshe Rabbeinu comes to the Jewish people and says, I'm taking you out of Egypt, he says, and says the Kuzari, one of the miraculous things Moshe Rabbeinu did was he said, I'll tell you world history. I'll tell you what happened from Adam till today. I'll tell you the genealogy recorded at the end of our parsha, right? Noah has a son, Ham. Ham has a son named Mitzrayim. There was a man named Mitzrayim. He was the son of Ham. How do we know that? It says it in the parsha. How else do we know it? We said it tonight. Tonight we all said it. We all said it tonight. What did we say? What did we say? In the evening prayer, we speak about the Jewish people. Hakel haose lanu nekama befaro. Otot umofetim. Hashem took revenge of Pharaoh and he did wondrous things. Be'admat b'nei Cham, in the land of the sons of Cham. We say it in Ma'ariv every night. We remind ourselves, Mitzrayim is the son of Cham. It's a pasuk, b'nei Cham. Kush u'Mitzrayim. The pasuk records it. So Kuzari says this, the end of our parasha that records the genealogy is one of the miraculous things that Moshe Rabbeinu did. Ramban doesn't go that route. Ramban says Avram met Shem, Noah's son. So there, you just encapsulize 10 generations. And Avram met Yaakov. And Yaakov, right? And Yaakov met Amram, Moshe's father. So in four people, you've just closed the gap from Noah to Moshe. Right? So Ramban says the whole world must have known about the flood. The whole world must have known about Noah. Everyone knew there were sons of Noah. If Adam was able to tell everyone, hey, you're my kid, and he's your kid, so he's my kid's kid, and he is his kid's kid's kid, and you're all my kids. There's no one else here. God created me. So the world, from Adam Arishon, had a hard time denying Hashem as the creator. And says Ramban, you had a reset button with Noah, where Noah says, hey, I'm a descendant of Adam, and I only had my ark because Hashem told me, and you're all my kids. There's no one else out there. So again, the world hits a reset button with Noah, which could not have been forgotten by Moshe Rabbeinu's time. That's the Ramban's argument. Now that's a difficult argument we have to contend with. Then how are they pagans? What's going on there when Paro says, Lo yadati et Hashem? I don't know who Hashem is. So Ramban will learn. That means I don't know the Tetragrammaton. I don't know the Yud Kei Vav Kei, but I know there's a creator. So that's, again, with Noah we hit a reset button. Okay, so we start the parsha of Noah. Whenever we approach something physical that is commanded by Hashem, so we're approaching something which is slightly Kabbalistic. Hashem doesn't need anything physical. Does it matter to Hashem? He's going to save Noah. So Hashem couldn't say, go up a mountain and I won't make it rain on that mountain. No, build your ark. He builds his ark, but they don't fit in the ark anyways. If you do the math, how many elephants, rhinoceros, how many cats, lions, tigers, bears, wolves? How many could you fit on the ark? Aside from food, it just doesn't fit. A year's worth of food, you look at the measurements, there's no natural way that could have worked.
as far as we understand. Unless you say evolution, there were far less species at that time, and they evolved. But our assumption, Chazal's assumption, is that Chazal is an acronym. Chachmeinu Zichronam Livracha. Our sages of blessed memory. Chazal's assumption is that it was miraculous. That there's no natural explanation for how it worked. So, Noach builds the ark for 120 years, and Hashem gives him exact measurements. The importance of that is more Kabbalistic than it is literally understood. And Hashem says, I'm going to destroy all of life because Malea ha'aretz chamas. The land has filled with chamas. What is chamas? Forced theft. And here we see a rule that repeats itself throughout Tanakh. Hashem is willing to forgo His own honor many times, but when people steal from one another, there Hashem says that I'm not willing to deal with that. That's not going to happen. Hashem is more careful with us about ourselves. Now here are a few scary facts. We're not allowed to steal. Okay? Sounds simple. Your roommate left his shampoo in the shower. Can you take some shampoo? Your roommate left his pen on the table. You just want to write down a note. Can you use his pen? Our assumption is that a Jew will forgo a minuscule amount that doesn't cost him 50 cents. Our assumption is that a non-Jew will not. That means that people who are in the conversion process, and Baruch Hashem, we have a lot, so then you better be very careful not to use their pen without permission. They have to be careful not to use someone else's pen without permission. Now, the truth is, that's the appropriate way to behave even so, irrespective of whether a person's a Jew or not yet a Jew. But it's more severe with someone who's not yet a Jew, because then it's mamash theft. We learned Tehillim on Thursday nights. Yes? Thursday nights, we learned Tehillim. So, I read Tehillim with the ancient tune. I told you guys this story? Yeah? Every year, the guys would ask me, how do you know the ancient tune for Tehillim? And I tell them, it took me 10 years searching till I found the recording, which I still have. My brother found the recording. Rabbi Jeremy Weider from Yeshiva University converted the recording from a tape to MP3 and emailed it to my brother, who emailed it to me. And on the recording, Rabbi Cohen says, you can copy my recording for other people to learn how to read these ancient tunes of Iyov Mishlei Tehillim. Most people don't know how. I'm saying, I don't know if 0.01% of the Jewish people know how to read. I don't know if 1 in 10,000 Jews know how to read the tune of Iyov Mishlei Tehillim. And it might be 1 in 100,000.
Where was it located?
There's Sephardim and Yemenites that have a tradition, but that's it. It's very, very rare and hard to come by. So Rabbi Cohen made a recording. I don't know who this Rabbi Cohen is. And he said, you're welcome to copy my tape, give it to other people. So Rabbi Jeremy Weider gave it to my brother. My brother gave it to me. And the students at the Machon every year would ask me to put it online. And I'd always say no. And they'd say, but the tape says you can copy it. And I'd always say, but until I find the author of the tape, copying it is not the same as posting it online. He allows me to copy it. You want to copy it, you can copy it. You want me to post it online, I need new permission for that. I'm not sure it's the same thing.
Can you forward the MP3 through an email?
So first of all, I made a series here where I taught it in a system different than his, which I think is much better. People who use the system I worked with learned how to do it, and they read Tehillim, and they know how. His system, to my mind, is a little harder. You end up in the same place, but I think that system is much better. So I invented a way of teaching Tamei Emet, and it's online. You could learn it for free. But before I did that, we had a student here 5-6 years ago
who finally called my bet, and he said, I'm going to go looking for him. I said, then fine, contact my brother. I don't think he'll know. Contact Rabbi Jeremy Weider from YU. So he did the homework. And he went back and got a hold of Rabbi Jeremy Weider, and he asked him, who made that tape? You have the original. Can you give us? And he said, it's a rabbi, I think, Mordechai Cohen. And they started working backwards, researching, until he found him. And so he found the Rabbi Cohen, and he sent them an email, and he said, we have your tape. We converted it to MP3. Now we just need your permission to post it online. And Rabbi Cohen says, no. So the student from Machon says, but you say on the tape you can copy it. My rabbi always said that he's not sure if copying it meant posting it. What do you care? And he said, copying it is not posting it. I appreciate your rabbi's sensitivity. No, please do not post it. I'm not comfortable with it being online. He said, I made a tape. I wasn't about to put it out for millions of people. You know, it's one thing to say you could copy. It's quite another to post it. That's why I made my own system. I said, if I just say what he says verbatim, that's not fair to him. So I thought about it, and I set up a different system, and now you could learn it. It's there online. But my point is that it's tempting.
So there's no, like, copyright law in
halacha? There is copyright law in halacha. There is. But I didn't take his thing. I'm saying, you know how to sing Beethoven Symphony. You can post it. You can't say, hey, don't sing Beethoven Symphony. Okay? Anyways, that's why I didn't copy what he did. My goal is the final product, but the system's not his system. At any rate, coming back here, it's very tempting in theft to give ourselves excuses. And one thing leads to another. A person has to always take two steps back and attempt to be neki kapayim, clean hands. We move forward. So Hashem says everything they did wrong ultimately led up to the highlight, so to speak, or the nadir, the depth of stealing. That's when Hashem says, now that's it, it's finished. Their fate was sealed over theft. So Hashem tells Noach, I want you to take of the pure animals 7-7. How did Noach know which were pure? So Chazal tell us a medrash that Noach knew because he learned Torah. That's what Rashi says. Another understanding is that the pure animals are those that are not disgusting to eat. The animals that people feel comfortable eating, like sheep, like goats. That's why Hashem says they get consumed, so I want you to take 7 of each. But the defiled animals, who's going to eat them? You find non-Jews that eat pork and rabbits. So, yeah, the animals that are tamei but get consumed, so they have a tendency to procreate far more quickly. They have many, many kids, and that's why they didn't need that advantage of having 7 to start with. When Noach will come out of the ark, he will sacrifice from the pure animals. They say, wait a second. You have the only 7 sheep in the world. And you're going to slaughter some of them in honor of Hashem? How? So the Tosfos, Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, he says, we find in Tanakh that one male sheep could impregnate 10, 15, 20, we'll see it later on. And yet Hashem told him, put aside 7 males and 7 females. Noach said, what do I need 7 males for? I need 1 male, 2 males. I don't need 7. From that he understood that some of them were for a sacrifice. And that's why he sacrifices them when he comes out. So he has pairs of the impure animals. And Hashem tells him, you enter the ark, you and your sons, and your wife and your daughters-in-law. From here, Hashem alludes to a halachic concept. If the whole world's suffering, you shouldn't be intimate in that ark. And Chazal tell us, so Noach separates from his wife. Chazal say there are 3 that transgressed this in the ark. There are 3 that mated with their spouses in the ark. One of them is Ham. The other one is the raven. Noach goes into the ark. This is a halachic concept, which we do not keep today. It's very interesting. Even though it says in halacha, it says in Talmud, it says in Shulchan Aruch, when there's a time of danger, when there's a time of suffering, people have to separate, as we will see. Yosef separates from his wife the second the famine begins. And again, this concept is quoted in Talmud and in Shulchan Aruch in Halacha. Practically, we don't do it. And it could be the reason we don't do it is because we've suffered so much in Jewish history. Who knows if there'd be a Jewish people if we did it? There were pogroms. There were Jewish history is replete with suffering. So now people won't procreate. People had kids in the Holocaust. I'm saying people didn't say this is what's going on. That's it. No more. Technically, in Halacha, it says people separate from their spouses when there's a time that the Jewish people are suffering. When missiles were falling on Israel. So I asked the rabbinic leaders, is it a time where everyone has to separate from their wives? And they said, no way. So, okay. So we don't do that. Part of it is also because the missiles were falling on the north and we live in the south. But that's a tough explanation. So everyone else is having kids and Noach isn't. He's 400 years old and everyone else has had kids and he doesn't. Everyone else's kids will be wiped out. And Noach's kids will live. And that's very often the rule in life. Very often we have challenges and we don't realize that the challenge is a blessing. It's not what we'd like, but it's still a blessing. Okay, so it's going to rain for 40 days and 40 nights. And how did the flood come? The Talmud says in Tractate Rosh Hashanah that Hashem made things in the heavens change. Stars shifted from their constellations and so there was a flood. And even from under the earth, the waters came shooting out and boiling water, and the people couldn't handle it. They tried going up to the mountains. Everything was destroyed. Okay, was there day and night during the period of the flood? That's not clear in Chazal. Machlokas. The Sephorno and the Malbim say that everything changed with the flood. That until the flood, you didn't have seasons. Every day was a 12-hour day and a 12-hour night. It was just like the equator. And the weather was always beautiful, like the equator. And so the Sephorno and the Malbim say, the earth tilted on its axis with the flood. That was one of the things that shifted. And that's why we started having seasons. And that's why the atmosphere changed. And suddenly people had to eat meat. Before the flood, everyone was vegetarian. After the flood, we're told you could eat meat because everything changed. People needed the meat. Yes? So the Medrash says that the earlier generations were granted longevity. Why? So one explanation says, simple. Adam was created by God. So he didn't have indigestion, he didn't have bad genes, he didn't, you know, life was perfect. Okay, so he messed up, so he would have to die, but he could live till 930. And then slowly the generations degenerated to the point where our average lifespan is 70 years.
Where did he mess up?
I didn't follow.
Yeah.
So that's pshat. But there's a medrash that says that Hashem purposely gave the earlier generations long lives so that they could master nature. They're kicked out of the Garden of Eden. They have to learn how nature works. Well, if you have year after year to look at the stars day after day, and to look at the plants and see that when you eat this, your body reacts this way. When you eat that, your body reacts that way. They became masters of nature because they were granted this longevity, hundreds of years to observe nature. Well, it could be their measure of a year was based on the sun or the moon. They had lunar months. You don't need seasons. They also celebrated Rosh Hashanah, the day of man's creation. But you are correct that there is a big discussion about whether the years prior to the flood are the same years as after the flood. That's a big discussion among the commentaries. We saw three opinions on that. When it says they lived to 900 years, what is that the same 900 years as our 900 years? Right. So, they come out of the flood to a different world. Noach is one of those people that saw three worlds in his lifetime. As I'll say, there are three people that saw three worlds. Noach saw the world inhabited, and then he comes out of the ark and he sees a new world. It's all destroyed. Nothing. I don't know if we can imagine what it's like to come out of the ark.
to see a world of total destruction. You know, did you ever imagine what a nuclear war would look like? Imagine you're the sole survivor, you come out of a nuclear war. You and your family. And you look around and everything's destroyed. Trees, plants, animals. Nothing's here, no houses. It's dead. And you got to start from scratch. So that's Noah. And he lived to see the world inhabited again. He saw the third world. Now that's a recurring theme in Tanakh, that people have to be able to stand up from destruction. Meaning we in life, we sometimes have to be prepared to see the world we built destroyed and rebuilt. And this is, again, a recurring theme where people will build and build and build. It says when they rebuilt the second Beit HaMikdash, they made a mass celebration, they brought music, and the people who had seen the first Beit HaMikdash were crying. Because when they saw the second Beit HaMikdash, it says in the book of Ezra, they were so upset. This is a Beit HaMikdash. I remember what the Beit HaMikdash used to look like. So they looked at this dismal Beit HaMikdash and they wept. And you couldn't hear them. It blended into the music. But the book of Ezra records it. Now, we are sometimes in life, we're tempted to hold on to the dream of what was. And sometimes we have to face reality. I'm not where I was. And now I have to rebuild. My task is to rebuild. Eov was a healthy person. He had a healthy family. He had wealth. Everything was good. And then his whole life collapsed. His children were lost. His wealth was lost. His fame was lost. His body was destroyed. His everything was destroyed. But he rebuilt. Daniel saw the Jewish people at their golden era. Then he saw the destruction of the temple. And then he had to rebuild. So this is a recurring theme in Jewish history. The giants of Jewish history undergo tragedies, but they rebuild. And the same is true with Avraham Avinu, we will discuss. So, Noach is in the ark. And it's very hard in the ark. It says he was spitting blood. It says that it was the most difficult thing for a person. At every hour, he'd have to run and feed the different animals. He had to figure out what every animal eats. It says Noach was not a zoologist. He didn't know. There was one bird which anything he fed her, she wouldn't eat. And then one time, he's standing there in front of the bird saying, "I don't know what to feed you." And a worm fell off of a beam. And the worm went and ate that worm. So then he understood, okay, this bird needs that worm. Okay, so Noach's in the ark. And we do not find Noach praying. And this is one of the lessons, that Noach does not pray. Avraham Avinu is told, Sodom and Amorah are going to be destroyed. Avraham prays. Avraham Avinu is told, go bind your son. He prays. One of the themes of the Torah is our responsibility to pray and try and change what Hashem's decreeing. We have a task in this world, and part of it is also to talk to Hashem. Okay, so the waters descend, and the ark lands on the mountain called Ararat. Noach tries to send out the raven. Your kid is going to come home and tell you the Medrash. The raven circled around the ark and wouldn't go anywhere. Tosa says the ark went and ate. The raven went and ate corpses. But it wasn't going beyond that. Because the raven doesn't have where to rest. So the raven would eat corpses. I never understood, do ravens eat corpses? I was once babysitting the kids. We went outside to play. There were ravens around. And I was feeding them leftovers from Shabbos. So at one point, the kids finished the chicken they were eating. And they wanted to throw it out. I said, wait, let's see. So we took the chicken bones and we put them on the side. And we saw the ravens when they thought we weren't looking came down and grabbed it. I didn't know ravens eat chickens. They do. They like my wife's schnitzel. They like her chicken. They have good taste. But at any rate, then I saw with my own eyes that ravens are predators. I didn't know that. So the Tosfos says that the raven wasn't going to go beyond the dove because the raven was eating corpses, whatever it could find floating. Yeah.
I read somewhere that that's the reason that the ravens are not kosher now. That because they and birds are like doves.
Okay.
They don't have
Thursday night. I'll be happy to come back and discuss that. He sends the dove. And the dove is a better bird because when the dove flies, the dove can flap one wing and keep flying. It can let one wing just hang there and the other wing does the work, and then let the other wing hang there and the other wing does the work. So the dove can alternate, and that's why the dove can spend much more time airborne. And so the dove is going around and doesn't find anything, and he waits 7 days, and then he sends it out again. And here we learn a concept. If you want to gauge change, wait 7 days. This concept will appear again and again and again in Torah. When you have a person who has a white blemish, tzaras, you want to know, did it grow? Didn't it grow? When's the next time you check? After 7 days. The rule is, the gauge for change is seven days. He sends it out a second time, and after 7 days, right? The dove comes back. And this time the dove comes back with Ale Zait Taraf Bifia. It has an olive leaf that has been pulled off a tree in its mouth. So now he understands that there are trees out there, that the trees that are growing. And he understood that the water has completely settled. Okay, waits another 7 days, sends it out, and the dove doesn't come back. Now, another hallmark of the dove is that the dove knows how to find its way back. And that's why the Jewish people are compared to the dove. Because the dove knows how to come back home. And the Jewish people, even when they think they're lost and they're very far away, they know how to come back home. So the dove doesn't come back. He understands that she's found a place to nest. So Noach comes out of the ark. And Hashem tells him, come out of the ark, and you can go back with your wife. Chazal tell us that even though everything was dry, they weren't ready to leave. Psychologically, Noach's family was not ready to leave the ark. If you think about it, it's a scary thing. If a person lives a whole year in one room, and suddenly you're told, go out and face the world again, it can be scary. Noach is told, if they don't want to come out, you force them out. And that's an important rule also. Sometimes, you know, what's the first thing you do as an educator? As a parent? Right? A couple came to a rabbi and said, our child is going to be born in a month or two. And we want to know, at what age do we have to start educating him? And the rabbi said, you're 8 months too late. Education starts in the minute of conception. You're not talking to the kid. Pray for the kid. Part of education is, sometimes the kid has to go to sleep and they're crying, take me out of the crib. And you have to be able to know that there's an age where the kid has to go to sleep. And then the kid reaches an age where he has to go to school. And you're thinking, I'm going to part from my kid. Yeah, you're going to part. You're going to do like all parents do. You're going to cry a little bit. And you're going to let your kid stay in God and do what normal kids should do. So sometimes you got to leave the ark. You got to leave the security. Noach offers Hashem a sacrifice. And Hashem says, no more. Man has a yetzer hara. And I won't destroy all of the living creatures like I did until now. But part of that is I will not cause the seasons to stop. That's an indicator that the seasons stopped during the flood, that all of the normal sequence of life stopped. And Hashem blesses Noach that he should procreate, and that now he's allowed to eat meat. But he has a mitzvah not to eat meat that's aver min achai. Recently I heard that all non-kosher meat in America is aver min achai. That the way the law has them, I don't know in Europe, but in America, the law allows them to chop up the meat before the animal is halachically dead.
we would require the animal to stop dancing around. We would require the animal to be completely dead. And they have a different, the law, I don't know exactly what it is, but the law has a different definition of what the animal's death means. And so, this is what I heard in a class from YU, I think, that the A&P meat. Now that means that a non-Jew is not allowed to eat non-kosher meat. You gotta check out if that's factually true. But that's what I heard. Torah says man is not allowed to commit suicide, even a non-Jew. Hashem says, I'm going to hold the person accountable if he commits suicide. Really, what you going to do to him? You going to kill him? What does that mean when Hashem says, I will demand of you if you commit suicide? Guys, give me the answer. It's an obvious one. This is a proof that there is a soul and an afterlife. If Hashem says, if you commit suicide, I will take you to task over it. People often ask, where does the Torah say there's an afterlife? Here you have a pasuk. The pasuk says, I'm taking you to task. People say, where does it say Gan Eden and Gehenna in Torah? I just told you a pasuk. The pasuk says, I will demand, umiyada adam, shofech dam adam ba adam damo yishofech. There's another pasuk here. Pasuk says, he who spills the blood of man from man, his blood will be spilt. So, Talmud says there's this thing called Sefer Yetzirah. God gave us a book that tells us how God creates man, and if we want to, we can create some kind of creature that's like a man, right? You all heard the folklore of the Golem of Prague. See, this is probably folklore. Who knows if it ever happened. You heard about it, right? The Maharal was the rabbi in Prague, in the generation directly overlapping with Rav Yosef Karo. And the Maharal, people want to say, he created a creature called the Golem. Well, it says in Talmud there were rabbis who knew how to do that. We have the book Sefer Yetzirah, not that we can make heads or tails out of it, but we do have the book. So, are you allowed to... What happens if you create a guy like that? Does he count for a minion? Are you allowed to kill him? What?
That's for Thursday night.
That's for Thursday night, but it's in our parsha. It says, don't spill the blood of a man, and these creatures don't have blood. It's like a robot. So Hashem makes a covenant with them. Hashem says he will never again bring a flood that totally eradicates the planet. And that's the sign of the keshet, the rainbow. And that's why whenever we see a rainbow, we make a blessing over the rainbow, that Hashem keeps his covenant not to bring a flood. Chazal tell us that when there were very pious people, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai or Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, there was no rainbow in their day. They had enough merits that there was never cause for there to be a flood. Their merits were enough to for the generation. Yes. Seems that way, yeah. Seems that way. It's not a good sign, right? So, Noah finds some seeds from the grapes that grew back before the flood. Or he took them with him. And here we have a beautiful medrash. The medrash says that when Noah planted the seed, let's see if I can find it. I have it somewhere in my notes. When Noah planted the seeds of the grapevine, the Satan came and he slaughtered over that seed a few animals. He slaughtered a sheep, he slaughtered a monkey, he slaughtered a pig, he slaughtered a lion. And that's what Satan did was when man drinks wine, so first he becomes, I can do anything, he's a lion. Then he becomes tame, like a sheep. Then he starts making a fool of himself like a monkey. And finally he throws up and wallows up in his vomit like a pig. So I'm not sure I got the order right. I haven't been drunk ever in my life. But those are four stages of being drunk. And the Medrash says it goes back to what Sutton did when Adam, when Noah planted his first planting, which was grapes.
And so he got drunk. And he went back to his tent naked. I don't know. Maybe that's why he needed Sutton's help.
But you can grow wine all over the world. It's not equally good. But in Denmark, you can also grow wine. And it's a cold country. So grape were brought somewhere to Denmark. Wasn't
Wait. In, your question is relevant to every seed. He had to replant all the trees. How did all the trees continue growing? Right? So maybe some trees lasted in certain climates and others lasted in other climates. Right? He must have... Right. Right, but it says in those days they used to know the land so well they could taste the soil and know what could be planted in which soil. But we're out of time. We will pick up here, Bezat Shem, Thursday night.